One of the big unknowns right now is whether or not this virus can cause a lot of severe illness or not.
State health officials prepare for swine flu. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 27th of April. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, participants at the Indigenous Climate Change Conference struggle to come to agreement.
Okay, if you're not going to come to consensus here, the youth will draft a declaration. Because we all agree, we all have the same position here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
The state's chief medical officer says there are no confirmed cases of swine flu in Alaska, but he says it's probable the deadly flu will make its way to the state. This comes as the World Health Organization today inched closer to declaring the world's first flu pandemic since the 1960s. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
The swine flu outbreak has killed at least 149 people in Mexico, the epicenter of the outbreak. As of Monday afternoon, there were a total of 42 confirmed cases of swine flu in the United States. The closest confirmed cases to Alaska were in British Columbia, Canada. Jay Butler is the chief medical officer for the state. He says as of Monday, there were no suspected cases of swine flu in Alaska.
We are working hard to be able to detect cases if and when they show up in Alaska, and I really do suspect it'll be when rather than if. And working with our ongoing influenza surveillance to be able to make sure specimens get to the state virology lab so the appropriate testing can be done as quickly as possible.
He says symptoms of swine flu mirror those of seasonal flu and include headache, fever, sore throat, cough, and runny nose. Butler says the state has prepared a pandemic response plan that was developed over the last few years in response to concerns about bird flu.
This, of course, is playing out to be a very different type of situation in that this is a virus that very early on has shown that it can be transmitted person to person. The good news is it looks like the illness it causes is probably much milder than what bird flu does.
He says the state and federal governments are recommending that residents postpone or cancel non-essential trips to Mexico. The state is advising anyone returning from the Southwest or Mexico who becomes ill with flu-like symptoms to contact his or her health care provider. So far, Butler says the swine flu cases in the U.S. have been relatively mild when compared with those in Mexico.
One of the big unknowns right now is whether or not this virus can cause a lot of severe illness or not. And one of the mysteries is why are there so many deaths being reported in Mexico? And a good number of them have been confirmed, whereas the exact same virus has sickened about 40 people. Again, that's with laboratory confirmation in the United States, yet only one or two have been admitted to the hospital.
Butler says the state is keeping an eye out for symptomatic residents who have recently visited Mexico. He says there will also be close attention paid to any flu-like symptoms aboard cruise ships traveling in the state this summer.
Cruise ships are certainly something we're very interested in, and we've had some conversation with the CDC already about specific recommendations for the cruise industry, particularly as we're just now starting to get into the cruise season. We know from past experience that influenza can be transmitted pretty easily in cruise ship environments. Back in the summer of 1998, we actually had quite an outbreak of summertime influenza among cruise ship passengers here in Alaska and among those that had traveled to British Columbia and many of the cruise ship stops along southeast.
Princess Cruises, Holland America Line, Carnival, and Royal Caribbean Cruises were all contacted for an interview on this subject. The corporations did not agree to interviews, but instead issued individual written statements. The cruise lines say they are closely monitoring the swine flu situation and that they are taking extra precautions to ensure the health of their passengers visiting Mexican ports. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Late this afternoon, five more swine flu cases were identified in New Jersey. The scare is creating turbulence in the travel industry, including Seattle-based Alaska Airlines. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
Alaska Airlines is maintaining its full schedule of 17 daily flights from the West Coast to Mexico. Planes are still close to filled, but airline spokesman Bobby Egan says Alaska has joined other major airlines in allowing passengers to postpone trips to Mexico without penalty.
We are seeing an increase in call volumes from passengers who are just not comfortable traveling down to Mexico, and we're working with them to reaccommodate them as best we can.
The acting head of the CDC, Dr. Richard Besser, is recommending non-essential travel to Mexico be avoided, in his words, out of an abundance of caution. In that same vein, Alaska Airlines has issued face masks and gloves to flight crews and ground personnel in Mexico City. On Wall Street on Monday, travel-related businesses took a beating. Alaska Air Group shed 7% of its value. That was actually tame compared with the double-digit losses suffered by other companies such as Delta Airlines, United U.S. Air, and Carnival Cruise Lines. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Economic stimulus money continues to head to Alaska, now through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Interior Department announced yesterday that the state will receive more than $10 million for Fish and Wildlife Service projects in the coming months. Spokesman for the Alaska region, Bruce Woods, says the agency will fund 88 projects at refuges and other public lands.
It's a huge range of things, from habitat management or habitat restoration in order to protect specific species or in order to protect specific habitats, to some really mundane backlogs of maintenance work on Alaska refuges.
Woods says the projects were identified as priorities through the Fish and Wildlife Service's capital planning process. He says the exact amount of money that will be allocated is still in flux, but the Eisenbach National Wildlife Refuge is expected to get the biggest chunk, more than $2 million.
It's for a number of things. I think a lot of it is going to try to install some wind generation capability to service the refuge at Eisenbach.
Woods says energy retrofits at refuges and offices will help save money and advance the Interior Department's goal of energy efficiency. Other big budget projects include more than $1 million for fish passage and salmon restoration projects from Anchorage to Fairbanks. More than $800,000 will go to the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which stretches from the Arctic Ocean to the Aleutians and along the Southeast Panhandle. Woods says much of the money going to that refuge will be spent on habitat restoration efforts, which he's particularly enthusiastic about.
We've done a lot of work down there in eliminating invasive foxes, eliminating invasive rats, and I think the potential for a rebirth in some of those just hugely rich and hugely exciting seabird ecosystems is some of the most exciting stuff we're doing here in Alaska.
In addition to news about the stimulus funds for fish and wildlife, the Interior Department announced over the weekend that Alaska will receive more than $6.8 million through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. A little more than half is for road and bridge repair, and the rest is coming through the Housing Improvement Program to help build new homes for rural families. Senator Mark Begich's office says the housing funds will be distributed based on community need and ability to get projects done quickly. The road maintenance money is going to more than 30 communities to repair roads under the Interior Department's jurisdiction. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act is infusing more than $780 billion into the U.S. economy in an attempt to jumpstart it and to create jobs. Alaska is expected to receive about $1 billion total. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a nursing home in Kodiak wins high praise.
Everyone is doing their job beyond their capacity. And I'm from New York, so if they weren't doing what was right, they would hear about it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Each morning, the Alaska Economic Report provides updates on the most current Alaskan economic trends, APRN, providing the information you need most.
Alaskans' holiday from motor fuel taxes will come to an end. The legislature passed the one-year tax reprieve last summer when oil prices topped $140 a barrel, but failed to extend it during the session that ended April 19th. State Tax Division Deputy Director Joanna Bales says motor fuel taxes will go back into effect September 1st.
8 cents a gallon for fuel used on highway, 5 cents a gallon for fuel used in watercraft, and 2 cents a gallon for fuel used in off-road vehicles.
Bales says the full 8 cents tax is assessed at most retail stations, but people who buy fuel for off-road vehicles or boats at consumer pumps can get reimbursed for any extra tax they pay.
The way it works is if you pull up to a retail pump, they would have already paid the tax at the highest rate. So if you have a tank that's for mixed use, which a retail pump would be, because potentially you could use it in a variety of different type of vehicles, you would pay the 8 cents a gallon, keep your receipts, and then fill out a credit claim with the Department of Revenue, and we would reimburse you the difference between the tax that you paid and the tax that you were required to pay based on the use.
Bale says most people don't worry about the extra few cents it costs to fuel up off-road vehicles and boats. She says Alaska's motor fuel tax brings in about $40 million annually. Alaska has the lowest state motor fuel tax in the country. Other states' levies range from 12 to 39 cents a gallon. Consumers in all states pay an 18-cent per gallon federal motor fuel tax. The president of the UN General Assembly vowed Friday to take the results of the Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change to the Copenhagen Treaty talks. The participants were seeking to write a declaration, but couldn't agree completely on its wording. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
400 people from 80 countries couldn't quite agree on a point the youth delegates insisted on, calling for a moratorium on fossil fuel development on or near Indigenous territories. The dispute went on past the signing ceremony that was supposed to conclude the summit. The best chair, Patricia Cochran of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, could give UN General Assembly President Reverend Miguel Descoto Brockman was a statement of intent.
We have asked the UN General Assembly President to please take the information that comes from our summit and to forward this information to the bodies within the United Nations.
And Brockman said he would do just that.
I assure you that I will share this declaration with the members of the General Assembly for all to consider.
But it's not quite a declaration. The debate over the wording took place behind closed doors, but flared out in public when two members of the steering committee for the summit said they would not sign a declaration if there was no consensus. Committee member Ben Namakin from the Micronesian island of Pohnpei said he would have to stand with other youth who wanted the moratorium if it was not included in the declaration. The young people threatened to write their own, he said.
We have the right to do this. Okay, if we're not going to come to consensus here, the youth will draft a declaration. Because we all agree, we all have the same position here.
So after the ceremony, the summit went back to work. The hours dragged on until the early evening, when the deadline of the checkout time at the Dena'ina Center arrived. The declaration ended up containing two versions of the moratorium language, one saying there should be no development without consent, the other saying that the moratorium should not infringe on the rights of Indigenous peoples to develop their own resources. The UN General Assembly President was well aware of the divisions earlier in the day when he accepted the intent statement. He sought to put it into a longer-term perspective and said the summit had accomplished the task of amplifying the voices of Indigenous people in coming international economic, political, and environmental policy debates.
You have been instrumental in shifting the focus so that Indigenous peoples are now regarded as primary actors within global climate change monitoring, adaptation, and innovation.
For many of the summit participants, the experience was rewarding, meeting other people and discovering they had much in common in their concerns and ways of dealing with climate change. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
State troopers are asking for the public's help in solving a 1993 murder in Fairbanks in light of new forensic analysis. Troopers renewed their investigation of the Sophie Sergi case 2 years ago. The 20-year-old from Pitkus Point was found sexually assaulted and shot to death in a bathroom at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Bartlett Hall dormitory on April 26, 1993. Trooper Cold Case Investigator Jim Stogsdill says an independent forensic analysis conducted last year has broadened the search for clues in the case.
We had all the crime scene information and lab analysis and so forth reviewed by a crime scene reconstructionist, if you will, who outside the department. And he alerted us to the fact that it was entirely possible that Sophie wasn't killed in the bathroom where she was discovered, but may have been killed in another part of the building and brought there. And the significance of that, that people who were living on the sixth floor, the seventh floor, the eighth floor, or whatever, even though they might have heard something and saw something, they didn't put any significance to it because their belief was the crime happened on the second floor.
Stogsdill says DNA evidence collected from the crime scene is routinely run through a national database of offenders to look for a match. Investigators want to hear from anyone who was in the dorm in the spring of 1993, including those who have already been interviewed by police or those who don't believe they have anything to contribute. Stogsdill says investigators are following a fairly narrow plot line because Sergi, a former UAF student, was only staying with a friend at the dorm while in Fairbanks for a dental appointment.
She wasn't a person who you would expect to see deeply involved in any other relationships or anything going on at the time. She was just simply there to have her, you know, to have her dental appointment. So, what we're looking at is an encounter between her and an assailant, a person she may not have known at all, but somebody will have seen or heard her with this person or have some other knowledge. You know, and we just haven't found that person yet.
Sophie Sergi's murder took place during finals week at UAF, a time when many people were leaving campus for the year. That compromised the investigation. Some dorm residents were tracked down and interviewed, but Stogsdill says investigators were pulled away by another high-profile case that year, the disappearance of Alaska Independence Party founder Joe Vogler, who was later found murdered.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business, or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
U.S. News and World Report recently ranked the long-term care center at Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center as the number one nursing home in Alaska. Meanwhile, the care center's administration and staff are hoping to realize their dream of a new facility to replace its current space in the near future. KMXT's Eric Wander has more.
Care center staff and administrators accepted the honor with great pride. Nursing home administrator Judy Fine responded to the number one ranking and explained the rating system.
It's a rigorous set of parameters that you're graded by, so that's why I say we're very proud of being number one in Alaska.
Part of the Care Center's mission statement, which was developed by the entire staff last year, says compassion, tenderness, harmony, and healing of the soul is at the very heart of what they do. Margaret Hall's 92-year-old husband, Father Hugh Hall, has been a resident since February 2006, prior to which Margaret cared for him at home. She said she couldn't be happier with the quality of care at the center.
The care he's receiving is just excellent, and it extends far beyond these walls because the care he gets here gives peace of mind to my six children and also makes my life much easier, because I know he's getting excellent care here. The staff is caring and loving and compassionate, and I just can't find the right words.
93-year-old Mary Hennessy has been a resident for 7 months. Her daughter, Kodiak resident Betty Walters, brought her to Kodiak from her home in New York to live in the care center. Hennessy said she feels at home and that she's receiving the best care possible.
Couldn't be better. They are very, very efficient and overworked. Everyone is doing their job beyond their capacity. And I'm from New York, so if they weren't doing what was right, they would hear about it. We hold back on nothing.
Fine emphasized that although the care center provides top-quality care to its residents, operating in a 40-year-old building is not their preference. She said the facility should ideally provide a more home-like atmosphere.
We have half the equation. We've got the good quality care, and our number one kind of reaffirms that. But what we're looking at is replacing the care center with a greenhouse-like model, which is a residential, home-like neighborhood model of living.
Fine said the biggest barrier to realizing that model of living for care center residents is finding a way to pay for it. Borgie Holm, Public Relations and Communications Coordinator for PKIMC, explained the importance of finding a way to fund the facility. She said a large portion could be paid by Medicaid funds, but that the borough would have to fund the rest.
We feel the care center project is especially important because this is the only project where the people using the building actually live there. It actually is their home. And also the fact that for a lot of our residents, this is where they will spend the rest of their lives, and we want those last years for them to be as wonderful as they can possibly be.
Fine said she is grateful to all the members of the Kodiak community who contribute to the center and the well-being of its residents in various ways. I'm Eric Wander.
2010 may be almost a year away, but census takers start knocking on doors in Anchorage this week. Alaska's largest city is one of a handful of areas nationwide where canvassing operations are already underway to verify addresses. We spoke with Denny Luna, who's a media specialist for the U.S. Census Bureau, to find out a little more about it.
A census day is actually April 1st, 2010, at which time we need to count everyone in the country. And that's according to the Constitution. We have started our first major operation in Alaska, and we are across the state now checking on addresses. As you can imagine, a lot can happen in 10 years. Condos can turn into other things, and houses can be vacated, and new suburbs that weren't there 10 years ago can now be some of the fastest growing areas. So we want to make sure that we've got every address correct. The forms that will be mailed out next year will have accurate places to go, because we don't send to people, we send to addresses.
So why did you select Anchorage as a place to get going early?
Anchorage is one of the places that is, you know, central to your area, and we've got about 700 people that will be fanning out across the state. The operation itself is extremely important because it means three things for communities. One, it means dollars for local programs. The state takes the federal census data and draw their local legislative boundaries. We also use those numbers for electoral college and for the number of representatives in the House of Representatives.
So it's pretty important for people to make sure they're counted.
Absolutely. For example, if we have a number of seniors in the area, then we're going to know where we're going to build our maybe hospitals or definitely senior centers. And so it behooves everyone to be counted and counted in their neighborhood so that those federal dollars flow to the right places.
What's new this year? It looks like you're going to be, for the first time, including group living situations. Can you explain that?
We're now doing a count of where people might live. So it could be businesses that look like they might have homeless people in them. Those are going to be noted in what we do now. We're going to be maybe knocking on some doors and asking people, do you know of any other living accommodations in the area? The point here is to just count doorknobs, front doorknobs, basically. It's a count of the addresses.
Can you give me an idea of what to expect when I hear that knock on the door?
The address Congress canvassing part of the operation now is strictly to verify addresses. They are not going to ask any personal kinds of questions. They will be dressed in their regular street clothes. They will have probably a black canvas bag that says census on it, and they will all have census ID.
Denny Luna with the U.S. Census Bureau. Luna cautions that census workers will not ask personal questions regarding bank account or credit card numbers, nor will they ask to be invited into homes. The Matanuskas Susitna Borough released its proposed 2010 operations budget last week, a budget that reflects tighter spending amid slowed economic activity. Borough manager John Duffy says the budget is less than last year's by some $855,000.
We'll be able to maintain the existing level of services, and however, any major new initiatives, I don't think, are in the offering. And so we just had to pull back from a lot of things that folks wanted to do and then see if we can maybe take care of them in future years when the economy turns around.
The borough is facing a challenge of paying for unfunded state mandates through local property taxes, programs like senior citizen and veterans property tax exemptions.
Certainly disabled vets and senior citizens can use some help. However, the state has never provided us the funding for that. They just mandated these reductions, and then the local governments have to carry the weight. And so what happens is that all the other taxpayers within the borough or other municipalities are carrying a load. And for us, these unfunded state mandates translates into one mill throughout the area-wide and non-area-wide tax levies.
But the area-wide mill rate of 10.3 stays the same as last year, well under the borough cap, Duffy says.
The non-area-wide mill levy, which funds things like libraries, animal care, economic development, basically those things that we do outside of the three cities, that did go up, went up 0.06.
Overall, he says the average tax bill has gone down. The proposed budget includes a $1.4 million increase for education for a total of $46.1 million for Valley schools. Out of every dollar taxpayers spend in taxes, 75 cents goes to education and 25 cents goes for borough operations. That means borough operations must stay on the lean side with one employee for every 310 residents. Duffy says residential construction in the area is down from last year, and the average value of the Valley homes has dropped by 5%. But he says people continue to move to the Mat-Su, which is seeing a population growth rate between 2 and 3%, which outpaces projections. A public hearing on the Mat-Su budget will be held on April 20th and May 7th. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Tom Bonsi in Washington, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Eric Wander in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers
Alaska
are
News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.